To introduce our speaker for the night, John C.
My name is John, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
And I've got to stand up because I've been standing up since I got sober. And it's important to me to do that. Because I've fallen down many, many times in alcoholism. And since I got here, it's the first thing that I could ever get involved in that I could truly stand up and be counted as a member of anything, including the human race. I noticed that this group seems to introduce themselves as recovering in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like that. Because if I have a message to offer anyone, is that I'm not like I used to be. I'm quite a bit different. It doesn't mean that you've got to like what I am, but it means that I got to like what I am. And I have recovered, most assuredly, from a seemingly hopeless state of body and mind. And I owe that all to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that came, and the loving God that you allowed me to find when I got here. I guess that one of the things that I have found about myself in sobriety is maybe not that unusual, but it is not often said the way I try to say it, and I don't know how successful I am, but I am one of these people who got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous beaten soundly by life, and I knew that long before I got here. As a matter of fact, I was in the depths of despair many times in my life, but one time very significantly, it was 9 years before I got sober, and I was in Fresno. And I recognized that once again that I was a total failure in everything I'd ever tried to do. I knew that my wife was in great pain as the result of things that I had done. And I knew that my children no longer liked me and hadn't for a long time. I knew that I hated the world and that everything I had tried to do, I had failed at. And I could see no effort, no reason for continuing this thing, but I had little choice because I had so many kids that I was dedicated at least to living long enough to make sure that these kids had a fair start in life. But being married to a a beautiful Al-Anon that I was married to and am married to, she persuaded me and lied to me sufficiently enough for me to give it one more try. And when I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not because I was driven by alcohol. I didn't know that, and this is part of my helpless state of mind and body. You see, in the length of time that I drank alcohol, which was for, strangely enough, 30 years, give or take a day, I started drinking in the middle of March. 30 years later, I stopped drinking in the middle of March. And I did a lot of things in those 30 years of active alcoholism. But in that length of time, not once was I ever told about alcohol and what it was doing to me, to the friends and the people and the loved ones near and dear to me. By the time I got here, there was very few of those. I got here at the insistence of a friend of mine. Our last drunk together was the night I like to say that it's the night that they moved Bruner's, because I had to pick up a bench press at Bruner's, but I went there twice to find it, and it was gone. And that bench press is still on my bed today, and that was on the 12th of March this year. It will be my 7th year that I will celebrate in sobriety, 7th anniversary, clean and sober. And when I got here, this sobriety thing that you talk about had no value to me. It wasn't the attraction that was offered when I got here. I didn't even think I belonged here because I didn't realize when I got here the concealment by me, from me, as to the disease. The merry-go-round of denial of alcoholism was so great and so intense that I could not tell you in clear conscience that I had drunk a lot. I drank a little. That's to do less than that would have been lying, because I had no drunk a lot. But one of the things I saw is that I saw some sparkles in life. I saw these idiots laughing at things that they shouldn't laugh at. Smiles on people's faces, a sense of enjoying life, and God, life had ceased to be an enjoyable thing when I got here. What I did know, and I knew this, and I've known it for years before I got here, that only the good ones seem to die, and rotten bastards like me got to live. I come in with a hate, with an attitude of great hate, anger, concealed violence, or an attempt to conceal violence, with the sure and cold knowledge that I was unfit to live in this world because I was a killer, because I had killed in my alcoholism, directly responsible and indirectly responsible for the lives of several people. And I had relived that event so many times in my life, those events, trying to correct them, to do something with them, and I couldn't do that. And when I came here the first night of my first meeting, which is in St. Luke's, and it was actually my first meeting was March the 16th. I was 4 days sober when I went there. That particular night, I went in there and was called on, and I remember, because it's been reminded of me what I said that night. I said that I came in to see what the hell a creeps do on a Tuesday night, and stayed long enough to find out I was a creep. The attraction was great. The insults were even greater. There was a couple of people that insulted me grievously in my first meeting. There's a guy in this program by the name of Bill Joplin, and then I use his last name because he uses it all the time. He's the first man I met sober. I walked into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he walked up to me and he said, "I suppose you've got a drinking problem." And I laughed with a great sense of humor that I enjoyed and said, "Doesn't everyone?" And the son of a bitch said, "No." And I wanted to kill him right there on the spot. He failed to see the intense line of humor that I had there. And then I met a man who I sometimes call sponsor today after the meeting, who said that, or led me to believe that I didn't have enough guts to stay sober for 30 days. And I figured, with all modesty, do me that I'll stay sober and watch that bastard drink. And that's how much love I came in with on my first night. And I didn't come back to get what you had. I came back at you. And I stayed at you for a period of time. But what happened to me, and one of the reasons, one of the many reasons I can tell you that I'm no longer the man that I used to be, is that I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was relatively early in my sobriety. Only a matter of weeks, long before the 30 days was over, I fell in love with this thing, and I was given a set of tapes, and I call these set of tapes, and the man who spoke on them as my mentor or my original sponsor. Because although I have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, that sponsor has guided me through the steps, but the foundation of my program of sobriety came from my original mentor, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the principles given to me through my mentor and the 12 steps of recovery. And after being in this thing for a period of time, they talk about more being revealed to you. You see, strange things happen to me almost from the very beginning. And I know I irritate an awful lot of people in sobriety, because I'm one of those people that come in and seemingly get struck instantly well. And that's the appearance that I created at the very beginning, because I was struck. I wasn't well, but I was struck. And I was spouting from the very beginning words that I knew were true, but I didn't understand one damn little bit of it. I had more profundities that I could offer in my first few months of sobriety that represented 30 years of sobriety. And the reason they represented 30 years of sobriety is because I stole them from a man who was 30 years sober. And they fit for me, but I didn't think they'd work. But God damn it, I was worth trying. And one of the things that they told me, and I used then, and I use now, and I pray that I shall always use. And they looked at me and they diagnosed me as the kind of person that I really am. And they said, you arrogant son of a bitch. A man like you has no chance for this program unless you do certain things. You're sullen and you're quiet and you're too good to talk to anybody. And so these are the things that you've got to do. You're going to have to start talking. But you're not going to talk out of the side of your neck. You're going to have to start talking real. But more important than any one single factor, you're going to talk about sobriety. You're going to have to spend the rest of your life chasing your mouth. You're going to talk good. And that's what I do. I started talking much better than I was. And I still do. I copped a phrase that is very keeping with me in sobriety, and I believe it to be true. Is that I'm not anywhere near as good as I sound. But I'm a hell of a lot better than most people think I am. Because that's true. My life works today. I can give a strong log today and I can match my story with anybody's because I've done what you've done. I've done what you haven't done. But if we've both been in the same place at the same time, we've done similar things. You see, I came in thinking that I had no drunk log, and yet I can list, if you would like, I can talk about the nut houses and the straitjackets. I can talk about the jails and the prison. I can talk about Skid Row, and that's one of the things that I think is even funny about me, because that's where I started drinking, on Skid Row. Not because that's where I wound up, it's where I started, because that's where the action was. When you are a proud, arrogant son of a bitch who has been gifted by a loving father with an ability to fight exceptionally well, and you're not adverse to proving that to anybody who wants to challenge it, you go where they think you can get a fight. And that's where I went, D.C. And I was awfully good at it. Too good, as a matter of fact, as witness the death of at least one human being. But I didn't like doing that. I've never liked doing anything I've ever done except when I got here. But what I did decide through the process of my drinking career is that I tried so many things and wanted to do so many things and had never done anything to my satisfaction. And all I did was deal with failure. First thing of any major import, really import, that changed my life is when the lady that I was married to delivered unto me a little baby girl. And I looked at that little child. And I wanted so desperately to be a good father. And as a result thereof, taking all of my keen intelligence, I changed my life. Because I no longer could do the things that I used to do. No longer playing in the street. Looking to tear people's heads off. Playing with the rough guys. And the fighting, and I had to stop because fathers didn't do that. And so I became a father and a businessman. And after a number of years and four other little girls later, I set the pinnacle of success in my chosen trade. And I was in the process of receiving a major promotion to go into a branch managership in another state. And the defects of character and the shortcomings allowed me to get involved in the very first and only affair I've ever had in my life, and the resulting in the suicide of my first wife. And when I woke up in the straitjacket, and the feeling pretty bad, and knowing full well that you've done it again, you son of a bitch. You've managed to destroy everything of any value to you. And there was no hope for you. And then I realized that I had five little tiny babies out there. And the only one in the world that was fit to take care of them had to be me. And I damn well better get about my business of getting out there and an amazing short period of time getting out of from a straitjacket to being released on the street in a matter of less than a week without need of psychiatric care. I was turned loose on the populace of Southern California and recognized that was my problem, and I grabbed my little girls and I ran north, because none of the bad guys were up north. I can come up here and take care of these little girls. And they aged from 10 to less than a year with the five little girls. And set out to become the best mother and the best father that a man could be, and I was good at it. And I like to tell the stories, and there's enough ladies in here that probably can identify. The back, because of recognizing the age differential, that I'm probably without the oldest bastard in the room. But I listened to my mother, and I listened to the ladies talk about ironing, and they got so sick and tired of ironing and standing up iron. This is long before wash and wear. But I wasn't going to stand up and iron, so I learned how to sit down and iron. Okay, now I want to tell you, if you want to learn how to sit down and iron, if you want to do it right, you got to do it left and right-handed. And so I was a left and right-handed ironer. And at that particular time, all my little girls had the most ruffly dresses with lace, and everything had to be ironed. And I had white shirts, and I was a businessman, and I wore suits and ties all day long. And the identification I have reference to is that I had the one dress which was absolutely outstanding. It was brown, and it had, of course, puff sleeves. It was all lace. It had rings and rings and rings of white lace. And I scorched that sucker. And I got infuriated because that was a brand new dress. And so I spent 4 more hours scorching the rest of it to match. Now that was the most beautiful brown and brown and brown dress that you'd ever wanted to know. And you just couldn't buy any lace that was so closely speckled brown that you could imagine. Though, it's funny, I haven't remembered that one in a while. I used to show that dress off quite a bit. I was pretty proud of it, as a matter of fact. Something that did happen to me is I was totally convinced I was the best husband and the best father that a human being could possibly be, and I'll be damned if I didn't meet a lady that thought she was the best father and the best mother that a woman could be, and she had a boy and a girl, and I got so enamored by this lady, and she apparently was sick enough to become enamored by me. And when I realized that she had, in truth fact, this boy and a girl, and a car, and a television, and enough money to buy a set of twin beds, I married her. And that's the lady I'm married to today. And we got off to a fairly good start. But knowing the life of an alcoholic, the best description I can give you is to my ups and downs in sobriety, because I'm one of those, and I don't know whether everybody fits his classifications, but this is the way my cycle in drinking goes, and this is the cycle that I'm attempting to break in sobriety. You see, when times got tough, it happened to be one of the times, the only time I didn't drink, when it really got tough, financially, economically, and grim, and I didn't drink, I busted my fanny and worked like hell until times got good. And then I had to reward myself, and times got bad, and I had to do the cycle all over again. And I have owned, or let's put it this way, I have bought 13 houses in the state of California. That would indicate that times have gotten pretty good. I've sold 3 of them, and I own 1. And that means I had to leave 9 of them somewhere along the line. And that means gives you an indication that times got pretty tough. And the one house I did sell was the house that I had built in Covina shortly before the death of my wife. And when I sold it, it only cost me approximately $30,000 to sell it. That's how much I lost on that particular sale. So my investments have not really been that keen in real estate. I got to a point in time, and sometimes I tell it right and sometimes I tell it wrong. And I'm just giving you a fast illustration of what happened to me to get me here. And the absolute inability by me to do anything about my life, no matter how hard I try. Because when I married Peggy, once again, I bought a new one. It was a scary one. I brought a new lady into my life, and I had two children in my life, and I wasn't so desperate this time. Oh God, I don't want to make any mistakes this time. I want to do it right, and I want to be a good father, and I want to be a good husband. Because when I tried so hard before, I had failed so badly. And when I came to this point in time in Fresno, and I was a total failure in a business, I went bankrupt. With every probability of my life, wife was going to leave me. Things were absolutely grim. And the only way I can tell you is essentially the way it is. Since when Peggy and I got married, we figured that 7 kids were enough, and we didn't really need any more. And so I had a vasectomy. And the reason I had that was just to be absolutely sure, because she had already told me that she had been, her doctor had advised her that she was physically incapable of conceiving due to some internal female problems. And when we were in Fresno, and this is 9 years before I got sober, she announced to me one evening that she was pregnant. And being an alcoholic, I took that to the bar and started discussing it with some of the people at the bar, and they felt that I had some reasons to be suspicious. Because obviously, if you're sterile and she can't conceive and she is pregnant, that there's something wrong. I sobered up long enough to find out that in true fact that I was the father of that child. It's amazing to me, in retrospect, that I managed to do that. Because that's not anything that I would have normally done. Because my past and my record would indicate that I would go crazy. I don't know why I didn't do that. I don't know how I even sobered up long enough to find out, but I did. When I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous through no efforts of my own, I realized that one more time you'd done it. You have been a total destruction. That line in the big book where it talks about the hurricane roaring, the tornado roaring through the lives of other people. That one I bought. I identified with that one. And all I knew full well that I couldn't live in this society any longer. When I hit the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, not alcohol got me here, the fact that there was no more hope. This is the way it is. Life isn't going to change. You can't trust people. You can't get close to people. Everybody you get close to is going to hurt you. God, don't trust nobody. Please don't put your feelings out there and let yourself get hurt. The lady I was so married to or so in love with when I got sober or when I got married to had turned into a cold, indifferent witch. My lovely kids, which were 8, had long since left. I had this little medical miracle that used to run and hide when I come home from work. And I love kids. I'm probably would say, if you would want to comment about that, people talk about children are one thing, but people who do something with children is another. And I love little babies. I'm a father or a type of person that can grab a sick little baby with colic and rock them all night long and wake up and come go to work refreshed because I love it. And I've done that with all my kids. And they loved it too. But after a point in time, they apparently realized there's something wrong with Dad. And they no longer want to sit on my lap. They no longer wanted to be around me. And that's the kind of guy who got here. And he knew full well the whole world sucked. It wasn't going to get any better and wasn't going to change. And all I have to do is live long enough, goddammit. I thought I was going to die long before I got here. But I knew I had to live long enough to give this last little kid a start in life. And it's kind of interesting to me, because I'm already much older than I'd ever expected to be. I think most of us have some conception of the fact that we aren't going to live very long. whatever our length of time is. There are so many of them. I'm one of the people that that's pre-selected the date that he was going to go out, not the date, the year I was going to go out. And it's interesting to me that I find that I'm not the only person like that in sobriety. Some people said they would not live, didn't expect to live past, and they would give a name, an age. And I'm a man that said I would never live to be over 48. And in true fact, I didn't. In the sense that the man who came here at 48. And they talk about in our big book at step 3 of the sense of being reborn. And I'm not the man I used to be. I don't know what kind of a man I'm going to be, but I am not the man I used to be. I'm an entirely different person. You see, when I got sober, I realized who was responsible for all of the things that occurred in my life. And I was able to see without exception my piece of the action. And I knew I couldn't live that way anymore. This is early in my sobriety, through the process of intense studying and this great love I have for Alcoholics Anonymous I had then and has grown ever since. I'm an AA freak. I love it. My whole time is devoted to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some other things that I do, I go to work too. But that is only what I do. The real thing that I do is Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to share with you some of the events in sobriety that I was told about when I got here by my mentor. By the way, for those of you who may be interested, the man that I have reference to is Chuck Chamberlain. I bought his stuff and I could recreate. My life has been recreated very similar to his in sobriety. He talks about working the 12 steps for the purpose by which the steps were written, for the purpose of sobriety, and the related disorders. The related disorders like the wife that was going to divorce him, the little kids that used to run and hide, the daughters that ran off and got married very early, the one that was home that didn't like you and was heavy into the drug scene, the grandkids that you have never seen and didn't expect to see because their parents, your children, didn't want to come home or want you to come there, a job that you hated, a world that you despised, all of those things you could call related disorders. It was a relatively soon in sobriety that these related disorders started to change and it dramatically became different. I saw a beauty in the world that I had never seen. I remember one evening sitting in front of the television set, and I don't watch television very much at all. But about 5 months after I got sober, my wife decided that she wanted to get into Al-Anon because my life was changing. I was becoming a different human being, and she thought she wanted a piece of this action and the goodness that was happening. And so she went into Al-Anon. And I was sitting home with my son at that particular point in time, and he was 8 years old. And we were just watching television. We weren't doing anything. The most fantastic thing ever happened to me. I'm just sitting there, not doing anything. And from behind me, there was a little boy. A voice cried out, and he said, "Dad, I love you." I am overwhelmed at the things that have happened to me in sobriety. Because it had just been a month or two before that Peggy had talked about it, and I was asleep on the couch. And my son Daniel looked at her and said, "Gee, Mom, I'm sure glad that Dad doesn't drink anymore." And Peggy said, "Well, Daniel, so am I, but why do you say that?" And Dan said, "Because he's nice now, all the time." Now, I didn't have the ability to be nice now, all of the time. I was too torn apart by the emotions and the rage and the injustices of this world And in the process of working steps, amazing things have happened to me. Amazing things have happened. They still happen to me. I ask, one of the things that I had to do is I recognized I could no longer work where I was working. And I had to quit. And when I quit, I asked my loving father that I found when I got here, or allowed myself to be found when I got here. I said, Father, I got a problem here and I got to quit this job. And I would like to ask you for a little bit of help. Because I want to know, I would like to get a job and I hope you help me find one. And these are the conditions that I put on the job that I was asking for. I said, Father, I'd like to have a job that hopefully would pay me enough money to live comfortably, that allowed me the freedom to work with other people, doing what I like to do. And immediately I went out and went bellied up, and I lost every dime I had. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, because out of that I became, was given a sense of freedom. They talk about the promises that are given in this big book. We're talking about the fear of economic insecurity has left me. It had left me. And I realized that I knew it intellectually, but I knew then that there was nothing outside of me that had anything to do with what was going on inside of me unless I chose to take it inside of me. Nothing outside of me had anything to do with my sobriety. Unless I wanted to bring it inside of me. I came here and I said, I don't want to hurt anybody anymore. I don't want to hurt again. And I knew that was impossible. You can't live without hurting. You can't live without hurting other people. And I haven't hurt anybody since I got sober. And I don't know how that happened. I remember waking up after 2.5 months, or 2.5 years of sobriety. When I say waking up, as I will have to tell you, and it's because it's true, and you don't have to believe it, but it's the truth for me, is that I believe in a state of grace for approximately 2.5 years, because I was in a position of taking no credit for anything that had happened to me in sobriety. I knew the source, and I knew the gift, and I knew that all I had to do was put one foot in front of the other, and I didn't have to take any credit for anything because none of it was mine. Now, I can say lip service to that today because I know that to be the truth, but I don't really believe it all the time. Then I believed it, and then I knew it, and there was no problem with it. It was a great gift. All things were new. But I was sitting there at a meeting on Sunday night over in Saratoga, and I became to the awareness that I was everything I'd ever wanted to be, and more than I had ever expected I would be. All my life I had wanted to be a good father, and a good husband, and I found that I had been one for 2.5 years, and the whole issue being is that I had stopped trying to be one. He said, I don't know what a father is. And I don't know what a husband's like. You see, I know what I used to think they were. Those are the games that I had to play. You know, a father, as an example, was the best of my father and none of his bad stuff. What I wanted to be and what I didn't want to be, what my parents thought, what my children thought I was supposed to be like, and what I thought I should be like for my children. And I got so goddamn lost up into the things that I was supposed to be and wasn't supposed to be, there was no opportunity for me to be or even have any conception as to what I really was. And that's the whole story of my life. When we get sober and follow the 12 steps as I believe these 12 steps are written in its absolute simplicity. I'd like to tell you that I worked them simply, but I did not. One of the philosophies I have in sobriety is that we stay here long enough to get the steps and the program complicated enough so that we can understand it, so that we can work them, and then spend the rest of our life getting them as simple as they were when they were first given to us. And that's what I believe I'm in the process of doing, and have been doing for a while. I have to tell you that my life has been working good for a long time. I was taught early that there were no big deals in sobriety. Now, I can tell you, if you would like to hear, some things that might be construed as big deals, but I have to tell you, they were not big deals to me. I can talk about going belly up financially in sobriety, and then I could tell you about starting a new business then and going the next 6 months without a paycheck and not drawing unemployment. And I want you to know that's a physical and a financial impossibility to do, except that it was done. I would like to tell you that I started a business at that point in time where it demands that the bills be paid approximately 45 days, a minimum, before you get any money. And I would tell you for a cold fact that every bill that we've ever had since the day we started has been paid on time or discounted, and it hasn't changed for over 6 years. The growth rate has been absolutely phenomenal, and you can't do that because we didn't start with any money. Okay? And I know that's a financial impossibility. But it did happen. It is happening. I can talk to you about my children, and I spend a lot of time on my kids because many people have children and can identify with this. But I talk about the son of a bitches that my daughters were married to. And the first son of a bitch was an old puke that I hated his guts. And the first thing I had to do in sobriety was go up to that puke who was too damned old, certainly unfit to be married to any one of my beauties, and I'll make amends to him. And I want to tear his throat out for the things that he was doing to my daughter. Not only that, he was a practicing alcoholic. And he was bad. And it was a bad one. And this is how my program works. And it's not necessary for you to do this. It's necessary for me to do this. But these are the things that I do in sobriety. And it's perhaps the reason why there is no big deal. It's probably why my life works so well. And there's a parallel in this. And we say in this fellowship, and we say in life, that if you don't get it right the first time, you're going to have a chance to do it again. And if you don't get it right the second time, you're going to have a chance to do it again. I want to tell you a success story, because everything I've got in sobriety I consider to be success. Not only because I didn't drink, because it is a success story. Now, I talk about this one son-in-law that I made amends to, that I didn't want to make amends to, but the step requires that I must become willing and to do this. And I did. Being a good alcoholic, I also made this amends with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he sorely needed it. Okay. And that was my first 12-step call to him. Shortly thereafter, I was able to persuade him to come to a meeting, the Sizzlers. And he went down there, and I remember this arrogant son of a bitch, and probably one of the reasons I can identify with arrogance is I still have a little bit left, is that he walked in there and he looked around and he went through the meeting, and then he asked me after the meeting, he says, "Do the same bunch of people come here every Sunday?" And I said, "Well, generally, there's a nucleus of people. We got a lot of different people coming through, but mostly it's a core group that comes." And he said, "Good." He says, "I've looked around here and I haven't seen anybody I recognize, and God, I don't like hanging around with losers." Nobody he knew was there. When one evening after I had been sober for a few years, we got another panic phone call from my daughter. And she was screaming and she was crying. It's one of many calls that we had received. that Joe was drunk, only this time he had his guns out. There was a fight going on in the living room, and our grandson was sleeping on the floor, and she couldn't get in. And the bodies were going around, knives were out, and guns were going off, and she was absolutely terrified. We said, honey, do you want us to call the police again? I wasn't there. This is my wife was talking. And she said, no, Dad, just talk to me. And maybe, and this was going on. It was all panic. And then the operator cut into my wife and said, Mrs. Carney, we have an emergency phone call. And Peggy said to my daughter, honey, I'll call you right back. And just then the guns are going off as the phone goes click. And the line was connected, and there was a lady on the telephone, and she said, Peggy, I got so tired of waiting. Your phone has been tied up for such a long time that I had to go, and I can't remember whether we were supposed to meet on Wednesday or Thursday. When I came home, which was right after that, there was no answer when we tried to call our daughter. My first response, of course, is that I'm going to go kill the son of a bitch. And I realized I couldn't do that. And then I said to myself, the lady, I'll go kill her. She's a member of this fellowship. And I realized I couldn't do that. Not that I didn't want to. And we talked about it, and we realized we had no choice. And this was on a Tuesday night. We went up to St. Luke's. That's where the lady was. And I was called upon. And I shared my story. The reason I was at the meeting is because I had a resentment. And that I had to get rid of this resentment. Or it would surely kill me. Or kill some other human being. And I did that one. And I was released from it. Now, very few people understood that. As a matter of fact, a bunch of our well-meaning members of this fellowship was more than willing to gather up a posse and go get the son of a bitch and bring my daughter back to me. We went home after the meeting, tried to contact my daughter. No answer. But we went to bed with our prayer for the well-being of our daughter and our grandchildren, not knowing where she was. And I woke up and went to work the following day, not knowing where she was. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, I had a phone call, and it was my girl. And she had been hiding all night. And she didn't dare come to our house because Joe knew where we lived, and he was crazy. And I told her to come to my office because he didn't know where my office was, and he didn't even know what the name of the business was. And so she came with my two grandchildren. And I told my secretary, go someplace for a couple hours. And I told my daughter, I've got to go somewhere. Answer the phone. And I can't tell you why I did that, but I did that. Answer the phone and take messages. And in the 2 hours that I was gone, she received two phone calls. Both of them were from members of this fellowship. Both of them recognized her voice and never had met her before in her life. When I got back to the office, there were two members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous playing with the kids on the floor. Before the night was out, she was securely in the bosom of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Well, that's a delightful story because it was shortly after that. That was Joe's last drunk, and as of December the 17th, he celebrated 4 continuous years of sobriety. But that's not the end of the story, you see. That's not the end of the story. Because my birthday is on March the 12th. On March the 13th, there's another story. Because I have a whole raft of kids. I have a whole raft of son-in-laws. I've got a whole raft of alcoholics. I got another son-in-law that went out doing the same thing. Except his frustration was because my wife and my daughter and my granddaughter were not in the car and she had to run. She had to hide. She went back to Oregon to deliver her child, our grandchild, in safekeeping, to come back and face this drunk. And when she came back, this alcoholic was sober. And as of March the 13th, next month, this young man will celebrate his second sober, clean and sober birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only thing that I could comment about that is people thought I was crazy then, and they probably still think I'm crazy now. And I'm running behind, and they're listening, and they're watching, and they know this story, and they're trying to figure out, why aren't you doing it yet? Why aren't you out there and tear that bastard's head off? Why don't you do the things that you used to do? Why don't you prove your manliness? And the only answer I can give you is the answer that I know deep down inside of me. I got nothing to prove to anybody. And the reason I don't have to do those things is because I've worked these 12 steps. I have worked them. I am working them. I shall continue to work them for the exact purpose by which they were written, for sobriety. And I know this, and I know this, just it's indelibly engraved in my mind that this is a program by which I can learn how to stop drinking for good and for all. It's a promise of a manner of living that really works. It has told me that all things are new to me. And what excitement there is for me today. When you stop to realize what one day at a time can mean, if you're able to incorporate it in your life, then I do pretty good at that. I get up in the morning with a new lady at my side every day. I see my new son every day. I go to a new job and do new things and have, by the grace of a loving God, repeated phone calls from fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am able to do 12-step work out of this office. I've got things in my store that are magnificent as the result of alcoholism. Anonymous, and it's all new to me, and I get to come home to a new life. Did I get this newness every day? Oh my God, if you ever stop to realize that I got sober at 48 years old and I'm coming up on 7, then that means to tell you that I've had a new woman every day of my sobriety since then, and that's so many I can't even count it. I've had new adventures, and I'm living in a new world. And I'm not saying that this is the way it has to be. I'm telling you this is the way it is for me. And it's very rare that I talk like this because it sounds like a bunch of bullshit. At least in this depth. But to do less than tell the truth is to deny the duty that has been given to me in sobriety. This is where it's at. I'll never have to drink again as long as I live, and this I also know too. And I'm never going to have to hurt again as long as I live if I don't want to. Now, I do hurt. But I found out something that I learned in sobriety. In this sense, that when my brother died a month or so ago, I was allowed the purity of the feelings without the pain. And I found out this, and I don't know whether it is of any value to anyone in this room, but it is of great value to me. I have found that there is no pain in feelings. I have found that the pain that I have always had has been as the result of the resistance to my feelings. The feelings themselves clear, and they're good. And they're right. And and they're warm. But the resistance to them, my personal objections to what has happened, is what's caused the pain. I can't teach that one. But this one I do teach. It's the same thing that was taught to me. Is that you work the 12 steps for the purpose by which the 12 steps are written, for sobriety, and don't pay any attention to your related disorders. The amazing things that will come to pass when you encounter settle. And the only unit of measure you have is the same unit of measure that I've got. I ain't the man I used to be. I've never had it so good. And as long as I remember what I was like when I came here, obviously, I will have to do something to avoid becoming that same man. And that's what I do. I've been doing it successfully for a long time. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why you could say, or why I do say, why the Big Book says that we are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You've been very patient, and I want to thank you for listening. Nobody laughed at the wrong time.